All right, welcome to Chicago Jazz Revealed. I'm Mike Jeffers here, live at Katarina's, 1920 West Irving Park Road here in Chicago. And I'm joined today. It's actually, we've got quite the show today. We've got Bradley Williams. So I know that you and I have talked by email and talked by phone every once in a while when you have something happening, which is a lot. You have a lot of stuff happening. But I want to definitely have you come in on this one because you are going to start a regular performance January 15th at the Jazz Showcase 2014.
That's right.
And that's going to be a weekly Wednesday night gig.
Weekly Wednesday night gig, and it's a 10-piece band. A seven-piece instrumental band and three singers, and I sing, and I'm the MC, and it's an actual show.
So it's like a variety show? Is that what I got off the
website?
It
is a variety show, yeah, and kind of modeled, well, when I was with Woody Herman, I traveled with him for 2 years, and I really, one of the things I learned, probably one of the most important things I learned was this idea of putting a show on wherever you were at, because that's the people from the 40s, that's what they did.
Right.
They were jazz musicians, but it was a show. And, you know, it was very carefully paced, and there was a lot of interaction with the audience. And I came to Chicago and played at the Gold Star Sardine Bar.
Oh, yeah.
Which was the closest thing probably to the Playboy Club or at that point in time. And that was a great scene, too.
Well, that was a great place to kind of learn on the job, right, to get your chops, because first of all, what did it hold, about 15 people, right?
Yeah,
but they
like
managed to
box.
Get 40 people in there.
One time they had a symphony orchestra in there, I think, and there wasn't any room for the audience. They had to stand out in the hall.
I know a lot of players came through there, but with Bill Allen, who ran the place, and he was kind of a character. I had Stephanie Browning on the show months ago, and she told Bill Allen stories for about a half an hour.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
well,
you know.
Then you've gotten your dose of that. Yeah, he was
One of those guys that was very, at least what I got from her and talking to Joel Spencer and Jeremy Kahn, everybody, you know, at the Sardine Bar, was he was one of those guys that understood how to perform and engage an audience, right? Because he used to tell singers what to do, what not to do.
Yeah, he was around Chicago in the post-Depression days when there was a real club scene and there were a lot of performers. And, you know, he understood that whole ethic of, you know, having something exciting going on in a club, you know, that was a wonderful experience. I found there that it was such a rich experience, except we just would have one singer in a trio and night after night, you know, and I thought it was kind of sad for the singer sometimes. I thought, well, she must be kind of lonely and she has to carry the ball a lot. And in my band, I have three singers and they kind of function more like a support system for each other and they all sing together. And, you know, it's kind of like having a section of singers, like a big band would have a section of trumpets.
Sure.
So that's one of the things I learned there, you know, and that's also where I started being a kind of an MC with a lot of the singers that came through there. I would talk to the audience, bring the singer up on stage, you know, kind of function that way. And when I left the Gold Star, I started my 21st Century Review, the original 21st
Century. The original.
Yes.
The original. Well, you know, talking about how you're the MC and how you're putting a show together, I mean, that's how... I mean, that's how it all used to work until the invention of television, where all of a sudden nobody had to think anymore, and they just turned on a box, and then the entertainment
was there. Right, and early
there,
television, you know? Really were those people that were stage performers.
Right.
They were, you know, and the early, I remember, I don't know if you're old enough to remember, but I remember like the Smothers Brothers show, the Carol Burnett show, you know, all of these variety shows that were kind of like skits and music and everything mixed together, and I thought that was such great entertainment. And that kind of seemed to just fade away over the years on television. It got more, you know, caught up in...
Well, and even in the clubs, too. I mean, you get into the reviews, you know, like those show reviews where they'd have the dancing girls, and then they'd have the band, and then they'd have this, and then they'd have that.
Like the Cotton Club, you know.
The Cotton Club, yeah. So what you're doing at the showcase is something similar to that?
It is. And actually, when we did this band originally started at the old Bop Shop.
Oh, wow. I remember the Bop Shop a long time ago. Yeah.
Kate Smith she asked me, I told her I wanted to do something special. She said, I'll give you a night. You workshop it, put it together. And we ran it for like a month on Saturdays, and that started about an 8-year run for that band.
Wow.
So you know, and that was in an art gallery kind of setting.
Mm-hmm.
There, right. We had lights and we had little skits we did in the show. They kind of faded out through the years. I may try to introduce some of that back at the jazz showcase, but we're going to have a poet. I was out scouting poets at the Poetry Slam this week at the Green Mill.
Yeah.
And, you know, trying to find somebody that would mesh with what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And we did have tap dancers as well, off and on, in different situations over the years. So it's, you know, in my mind, it's all music. You know, the music is part of everything. And this band is full of these very talented young players. I've been running into over the years, coming through DePaul, a lot of them.
Mm-hmm. Now you teach at DePaul.
I've taught at DePaul for about 20 years, just part-time. But they have a very high caliber of students, and a lot of them become professional jazz musicians, and they're around. And they're like little nuclear reactors, you know, I tell them. For the next 20 years, you're just going to be churning out energy, and whoever has the good luck of being around you is going to enjoy that energy, you know.
Well, talking about the show and talking about the original 21st Century Review, now, is this all music and skits and everything that you write yourself? Or
there's a lot of original music involved, but we do a lot of Duke Ellington things. Like when we were working with Tap Dancer, we did Seven Steps to Heaven, the Miles Davis thing, as a tap dance number.
Oh, that's cool, yeah.
You know, we do themes to movies, to 1940s movies, you know, just any kind of thing that's related to jazz.
Yeah.
But maybe sometimes there isn't a solo in a song. Maybe we just play an arrangement and then we go on to something else. I always thought in jazz settings, a lot of times this need to improvise on every song is a little strange idea because it just means you do fewer songs.
Right.
You know, it doesn't mean you improvise more or less. You just do fewer songs. You know, and so that's one of the things I try to do is keep the pacing moving. And we had a lot of great reactions when we did it before.
This has to take like hours and hours of planning and writing. I mean, I'm just thinking about how long it would have to take to put this whole thing together every week. Now you're going to do it every week again.
Yeah, ironically, I have more time at this point in my life than I did when I first started the band. I had two young children, and I was working all the time, doing jobbing dates and trying to get all the money together. And so I'm very excited about this run at it. And plus, I have like 200 arrangements I wrote for the first band, you know,
you
as a starting
pull
place.
Them out, yeah.
and we've got very talented people, and it's going to be exciting. I'm so excited to be at the Jazz Showcase. It's kind of a dream come true to be in a place that's been around since 1947.
Right.
And all the people, you know, the big posters he has in there.
Yeah.
We're going to do, one of the things I'm going to do is the big head medley. We're going to do like a John Coltrane number and a Duke Ellington number and then a Charlie Parker number, you know, for the giant heads in the club.
Well, you know, in the showcase, the room that they're in now, I think is one of the best listening rooms in the city.
I agree.
You know, acoustically wise and everything. But also stage wise, it's big enough for you to be able to handle this kind of.
Right.
So you're not
going
to be jammed together somewhere. You know?
Yeah, I just saw the DePaul band over there the other day, and, you know, it was not too much for that room.
No, there's plenty of room and everything. So now you're going to be there every Wednesday. Now, what made you want to start this orchestra back in the 90s in the Bop Shop years?
Well, I think I came out of the. When I left the Gold Star, I'd been the musical director there for about 5 years, and I thought it was a great recipe, but it wasn't stimulating enough in some ways. I mean, we tried to make it more interesting and funny and kind of like a little bit more show-like. Of course, coming off Woody Herman's band, I missed the horns, you know?
Sure, yeah.
And I didn't think we needed so many horns. It's a big band, but, you know, four horns is a pretty good sounding band. Duke Ellington did a lot of things with small groups like that. Count Basie did. And I thought, what if you took a band with four horns and you got three singers, you know, and you really made, you know, and what we do is we'll have a singer kind of in the, what do they call it, in the rodeo when they're in the gate, you know, behind the gate.
Oh, like in the queue. They're
ready
to come
like
out.
Yeah, like before the bucking bronc comes out, you know. So there'll be a singer waiting to come up on stage, and there's one up there, you know. And it kind of gets the – and then we'll feature somebody in the band, and they know that their feature's coming up. And everybody's kind of at their optimal performing level,
right.
You know, which is very exciting, not just for the audience, but for the band, mm-hmm. which kind of feeds on itself.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, that was really my original intention, was to find, I thought jazz needs to be very entertaining. I'm worried about jazz. I've been a jazz lover since before I could talk, because my mm-hmm. mother used to play records before, you know, I could even speak
right.
the language. And I'm worried that jazz is kind of suffering this competition from so much high-level entertainment in our society. You know, mm-hmm. people have very high expectations. If you go to a movie, you're a movie critic. You know?
Oh, yeah, I know, yeah. And then you just write a blog, and you're
yeah,
instantly
right.
famous.
Everybody, so they really have high expectations, you know, to be entertained. And I think jazz has to really reach for that again. That's my
yeah.
idea, you know, is how do you grab people's imagination like they used to, mm-hmm. I think, you know, personally. Like
right.
Peggy Lee. You know, a lot of the guys in Chicago used to play with her, and she had these wild shows. Richie Fidelli told me they'd be banging on a empty refrigerator box, you know, off stage, you know, when they're doing it. Is that all there is? It's like, is that all there? You know, they were just maniacs, you know.
Well, but that's the biggest thing, too, is I think that bringing the fun back into music, you know,
right.
I mean, it's one thing to sit in an academic situation and you're being very intellectual about what somebody's playing. And, but really when you break it down, if you're a casual music fan, I mean, you know, you go to a blues gig or you go to a rock thing or whatever, they just like the way the thing feels. They like the action on the stage. And, I mean, they're not worried whether or not that person's playing a 2-5-1 to whatever.
Right, the analysis part is not right. really a big deal.
They want to see people smiling and having fun.
I say that when I have a chance to work with young groups of musicians, jazz bands. I'll walk up to them after they play, and I'll say, that was great. You know, you're all good players. You understand
yeah.
the technical part of it. Now, what business are you in? And they all look at me like I'm insane. I said, you're in show business, my friends. So you better start acting like you're in show business.
Right.
Because all that other stuff, that's for you. Mm-hmm. The show business is for the audience, you know. And so that's kind of that's why I'm very excited to be in the showcase, because it kind of, the name of the place.
Right, yeah.
It has the word show in it. And
yeah.
it's such a jazz shrine. So it'll be a challenge for me to really make it kind of have a hardcore jazz mm-hmm. stream inside of it, but also be entertaining at the same time. And they've been courting a lot more local people lately in the last few years and opening their arms to singers and people
yep.
that are even more cabaret oriented there, you know. So I think they're kind of more open-minded these days too. So
well, you know, those days when you would have, you know, a headlining group in there from Tuesday through Sunday, it's few and far between when they can do it. But now, I mean, everything is priced so high and everything. I think it makes sense, though, because with Chicago, there's so many good talent, so much good talent in Chicago, that most of the time you'd only see that at the showcase, and they were the house band backing somebody up. Now it's nice that they're able to showcase something.
Yeah, and like the London House, you know, and like
right.
these people where they, you know, the room is there. The showcase is in a pretty great location, too, right now. You know, it's right downtown.
That's right.
And it's
kind right
of
in the South Loop.
Got a little bit of a cachet back there, you know, in the corner, like it's a little secret.
Hidden behind the Bar Louie.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I think the time is ripe, and I think it could very well take off. I mean, there's so many people coming through town.
Yep.
You know, people going to see Late Night Catechism and all these theater things, you know, that have been rolling along for years. I don't think there's a problem if you can find your
right.
footing, you know,
right.
which would be a dream come true for me there.
Well, let's take a listen. Now we're going to hear a listen, something off of which CD are we going to take a
this
listen to?
This is the first official CD that I produced called Songs for Swinging Sophisticates, Volume 1. And this cut is Lulu's Back in Town.
And this is something that you wrote?
I arranged it. It's a 1930s
okay.
tune that Fats Waller and people like that used to do, but we kind of turned it into more like a Ramsey Lewis kind of a
cool
in crowd.
All right, well, let's take a listen to Lulu's Back in Town here with Bradley Williams at 90.9 FM WDCB and ChicagoJazz.com. We're back here at Chicago Jazz Revealed here on WDCB. I'm Mike Jeffers. We are live at Katarina's, 1920 West Irving Park Road in Chicago. The crowd is going crazy as usual. here on a Tuesday. We're recording this show right after. While we're recording this show, we should let everybody know right after Thanksgiving. So I think the crowd is still full of turkey and cranberries and things. But that's all right. Later on, I think they'll get warmed up. They usually do and start screaming and stuff. It gets crazy. Now you mentioned Woody Herman, Bradley. How did you get that gig? Was it right out of high school?
I was down at North Texas State University, which was kind of the lower middle class Midwestern jazz mecca. You know,
where I went to school.
You went there too? You know, yep. they had oil revenue there, so so the tuition for the schools was negligible. I think I paid $1,200 a year or something like that. But I still didn't stay the course. But
there was a steer ranch right outside of the music, outside of the practice.
We did have horseback riding, and we could go out to a corral. And I rode four horses in one semester, four different horses. That was one of my favorite things.
That helped with your swing feel, I'm sure, right?
But I actually was working in Dallas. The year I left North Texas, I think I made $40,000 playing the piano, playing two gigs a day in Dallas. And I knew these guys that had been in the band program in North Texas that had gone on Woody's band, and John Adams, a wonderful bass player who's back down there, I think, now, actually recommended me. And I got called, and I got on a plane and went to Pennsylvania. And
that was it.
I had a very beautiful first night, which not everyone had on that band. But, actually, it was funny because this is a little bit pertinent to what we were talking about before, but I played this piano arrangement of I've Got It Bad and That Ain't Good. And it went off very well. The crowd liked it. I stood up. Woody said, take a bow. And I took my piano bow, you know, because the piano students learn how to bow.
Right.
And he was kind of looked at me in amazement, and he said, take another one. And that was like that's how I started off. He thought, and then he made this big speech about how jazz education was creating these great musicians. And I'd been out of school actually for a year at that point. But
take another one.
But you know, you could talk to Woody about Igor Stravinsky. You could talk to him about, Donald Fagen.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, you know, he had so many people. Chick Corea, he did that record with.
Right?
I mean, that guy, and plus he was a famous man in the 40s. He made $1 million,
oh, yeah,
you know, in 1946, I think.
Mm-hmm. Who does that?
Yeah, which is like, you know, $50 million today,
right,
or something like that.
Right.
That was a big deal.
Well, that would be amazing to be on the road with him and get to know him as your band leader. And then you see the people coming to see him. And, I mean, it's a legend right in front of you. You know?
Yeah, there was excitement there, and he had this connection. I was so amazed. I'll tell you one short story. We were in Montana playing at a high school in a gymnasium, and we were on stage, and they had folding chairs on the basketball court, probably 300 or 400 people there. Mm-hmm. They were all excited, you know. Woody gets up there, and Woody was in his 70s when I was on the band, and he was kind of hunched over, and he would walk up on the stand, and it would be like the ascent of man. By the time he got on the stand, he was like the captain of the ship, and he looked out at the audience and he goes, you're too far away. Come closer. And 300 people picked up their folding chairs and moved them.
Oh, really? At the same time?
At the same time. And I remember thinking, did that really just happen? Because that's a very strange thing. You know, that's a power.
That, oh, yeah.
You know, and he had that kind of connection with the audience. I really was fascinated with that.
Well, I think having that kind of connection and being able to connect just like that,
right,
with them
instantly
has to be something that you're born with, and then you know how to use it in order to do what you want to do. I mean, meaning, you know, he's writing all these great songs and he's doing this band. I mean, that's how you make $1 million when you're 1946.
Right.
You have something happening there,
right?
You know, now when you were on the band with him, I mean, was it just the hit parade? It had to be the hit parade, right?
Well, we did a lot of things from the 40s, but we also did a lot of modern stuff. We did Chick Corea things. We played a kind of a rock and roll version of Fanfare for the Common Man, the Aaron Copland piece.
Sure.
It was a real hodgepodge of different things. And although my favorite gigs were the dances, we'd go down to Florida and there'd be like 300 or 400 blue hairs, we called mm-hmm. them, you know, dancing. And it was like a tribal thing. The band what was floating on top of these people dancing. You were learning from them dancing the way they did in the 40s, you know,
right,
when everybody danced. It was kind of unbelievable, too.
It's pretty cool, actually, when you go somewhere and you see, you know, the more mature audience members get up and dance. They know what they're doing.
Right.
I mean, they know what they're
doing.
It's
serious.
Yeah, oh, yeah. I mean, that's what they used to do. I mean, it's an amazing thing. Now, at your show, is there going to be dancing?
We're certainly open to that. You know, I love it when people dance. And we've done a lot of dances over the years.
Mm-hmm.
The band was active up until about 2003 as its kind of original unit.
Okay.
Kind of mutated after that for a while.
Well, now, I know too, because we should talk a little bit about your small group stuff.
Sure.
your other CDs, because I know that we get those into Chicago Jazz for
sure.
Reviews and things. I mean, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but you seem to be churning out a lot of different projects on a regular basis. Is that something that just happens, or is that something that you're actually, you know, planning things out and doing it that way?
Well,
you just had a CD. I remember Eric Hochberg came down and played at the booth, and he had
right,
some
our trio
CDs.
Three,
yeah,
right,
three,
and that's a wonderful project. We just had a rehearsal the other day and did some recording with that, and that was kind of an idea of a cooperative between Eric and I, because we found our original music that we wrote had a lot of common threads, and so we thought we should do some work. Plus, he's playing over at that Cash 35 place. He's like a monster. He's been playing six nights a week for 7 years.
That'll help your chops.
Yeah, I know. It's like a staying on a skateboard. But then the string quartet project I did before that was kind of a long-held dream of mine. And after that 2008 stock market crash, I just thought, I'm going to take my money, whatever money I have, and do a project. I'm not going to let it just evaporate,
right, yeah, evaporate
suddenly, you know. And that was great. I mean, the string quartets to me are, you know, that's in a way like jazz, but in a whole different dimension. You know, the way those people play together and their tuning and their the overtones, and that was a lovely thing. So yeah, I've done a lot, but I kind of finally realized the thing I had the most fun doing was this big group, and it's a lot of work.
Well, not only
so
a lot of work,
fun.
But I mean, you've got to get out. Not to mention, you've got to put the whole show together. You've got to do all that, but then you actually like have to like doing the radio thing with me. I'm sure you're hitting other areas and other media outlets.
Yeah.
Because you
got
to get the word out nowadays, is to really pound that out to get people to come out.
Yeah, it's great, you know, because it's exactly what I want to be doing. So I have no complaints at all.
Right. Not yet.
Throw me in the briar patch. I don't think I'll be complaining like I did before.
Oh, that's good. You're more mature now.
I am. Right?
So that's going to start January 15th. It's going to be every Wednesday.
Right.
More information at BradleyWilliamsLive.com.
Yeah, or you can go to New21stCenturyReview.com with the 21ST in there.
And there's a link probably from
BradleyWilliamsLive.com as well.
And I'm sure that they can get more information on all of your other recordings and anything else that you have coming up.
Sure. And we, you know, we hope to see lots of folks down at the showcase. It's a very fun thing.
Well, and I always like to do this, give everybody the parking lowdown so that there's absolutely no excuses. But at the showcase, for those of you, all of our listeners that don't know this, the showcase is on Plymouth, which is basically a Dearborn station on Polk and Dearborn,
right
behind the Bar Louie. And you can park behind the Jazz Showcase for $5.
Right, at the end of the cul-de-sac there. Downtown for $5.
Downtown,
yeah.
And there's an attendant, and
right.
he lets you park your car, so you don't have to worry. He's not a valet person, so if you don't like that stuff, I know some people that just, nobody's. $5, you walk right in, and you see a great show every Wednesday night.
Yeah, I think it's still, you know, growing there. I mean, I think people are still learning about that location.
Absolutely. But, well, and it's right by Roosevelt University. It's right by all that whole scene in the South Loop that's just exploding. I mean, I remember when the showcase was at the Blackstone.
Right.
And I would not park south of the Blackstone Theater. And now we're walking all over the place down there. It's amazing.
The gentrification is taking over. Yeah.
That's right. Well, thanks for coming in. Well,
thanks for having me.
Why don't we hear one more tune here on our way out? What do you think we should do?
Let's see. Oh, Without a Song, definitely, with the Reverend Penny Jeffries.
Without a Song, the classic song, Without a Song?
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, let's take a listen here. Bradley Williams and his original 21st Century Review. We're going to take a listen to Without a Song on 90.9 FM WDCB, Chicago Jazz Revealed. Thanks again, Bradley.
Thank you, Mike.
And we'll see you at the showcase.
I appreciate it.
We're back here at Chicago Jazz Revealed. I'm Mike Jeffers, live at Katerina's, 1920 West Irving Park Road here in Chicago. Crowd's going crazy. See, I told you, they're starting to warm up now. Now they're getting ready to
it's
roll.
Our animal magnetism.
Well, I'm here with Mark Moltrup and Donovan Mixon, the two leaders, I guess you'd call it, co-leaders
yes.
of Montage World Jazz. And I know that, Mark, you and I have known each other for a couple of years now.
At least.
And, yeah, at least. And we've played together on numerous occasions. And then Donovan is new to the – well, I don't know if you're
relatively
new to the scene, but you were out of town, then you came back into the scene, right?
Yeah, I was overseas. I lived overseas for many years, and I came to Chicago.
And then you ended up meeting Mark,
mm-hmm.
and you guys apparently clicked musically and put this group together. Now, you guys played at the Jazz Fest, at the Chicago Jazz stage at the Jazz Fest.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And you have some out-of-town things coming up. But I thought it would be interesting to get both of you on the show because I'm always curious about musicians that are working together and like co-leading projects. Because usually it's like one person is just,
right.
it's their deal.
Mm-hmm.
But, and as we discussed when we were at the Jazz Fest and there was a chance I might have to play drums because somebody was having a conflict and I was like,
you were going to save
us.
Oh,
man. Because you guys
our drummer
don't write...
was working. He works with that other piano player. What's his name? I don't know.
Ramsey. Ramsey guy, right?
Ramsey's
oh, yeah.
Something.
Something like that. Yeah, he got stuck on Mackinac Island.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we found out about 10 a.m. and we're going to hit it. Was it 2 or 3? So
yeah.
That is begin playing. That's what hit means for those of our listening audience
yes.
that don't know.
Well, and the reason why I was like, oh, no, is because I'm working the Jazz Fest and then I'm thinking about all of these odd time signature tunes that you guys are going to play. And I'm like, oh, man, there's no way. My brain can't wrap around that right now, man. I've got people buying CDs
minute.
And posters here, you know. But you ended up getting a great sub and you guys.
Jeremy.
Remarkable.
Yeah.
Jeremy
and you guys just
Cunningham.
Sounded dynamite.
Thanks.
But I guess let's get a little bit of background from both of you, maybe Donovan first. Now, you lived overseas.
Yes, I was living in Europe, in Italy, and then Turkey. The last 10 years in Turkey.
Now, were you
in
there
Istanbul.
For music? Or were you?
Yeah, I was there teaching music at a university, and then I for 6 years, this is Istanbul, and then 4 years I had my own studio, private students, group lessons, and played concerts and went back to Italy often and to play. Yeah, it was that.
Now, were you
life.
Originally from?
No, I'm originally from New Jersey.
Okay,
but I do have roots here. I have a couple of nieces here. My parents lived here at one time.
Oh, okay.
So it was logical.
So how did you find yourself in Turkey? And well, I guess Italy and then Turkey. How did you find yourself over there?
Well, the story, I was working many years ago. I was working at Berklee College of Music for a number of years. And then they made the mistake of sending me overseas for recruitment to play in the Perugia and Umbria Jazz Festival in Perugia and do clinics and all of that. And they sent me twice. And so then that did it. I just had to take a leave of absence. And
you just loved it. You just
yeah,
stayed.
I just loved it. Yeah, we were playing Jazz Festival in Umbria, and there were big stage, and there were go-go girls on each side of the stage. I said, I like it here. So, something different. So I just had to investigate a little further. Went to Italy and ended up staying. Ended up quitting my job and staying for 8 years and then moved on looking for a job. I decided I would look for another teaching job and accepted a position at Istanbul Bilgi University and taught music there. It was was vice chair for a year and played music and just lived there. Yeah, it was
now what was you were playing jazz and all different styles in Turkey?
Yeah, I was playing primarily jazz music and mostly my music. I just gravitated. In Italy, I went playing standards, and that's how it started. I was just playing standards, but slowly I started to play my own music, and people were telling me, Donovan, you have to play your own music. And when I started playing original music, I started getting more gigs, you know.
Really?
It was interesting, yeah. So it was no going back after that.
Yeah. How did the audiences take, not even the audiences, the students. I mean, what was the caliber of student?
In Istanbul?
In Istanbul, yeah.
It varied from, you know, really beginners, and then there were some that were quite masterful in Turkish music,
right.
You know. But they had a lot of interest in jazz and took to it quite well. In fact, we grew a jazz scene in Istanbul because there were several other American teachers there. Ricky Ford was there, was on staff, and I'm forgetting an important name right now. You know the musician, he recently died. He invented conduction, Butch. Butch Morris.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Butch Morris was there, and then there were several others as well. And so it was an important time for
the
jazz
scene. And
that
had to, just the entire culture and everything had to rub off on what you were writing too, right?
After a while, I started to understand and feel in odd meters and have a more of a sympathy for different modes and. Yeah, it was important. I thought I was going to learn a Turkish instrument, but no, I just didn't get around to it. It was just too tough. I just had a lot to do. But just being there and hearing the music and trying and just being affected, it did affect my composition and even playing. Yeah.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Sure. How did you end up leaving Turkey and coming to Chicago?
It was just time. I was planning. Actually, just to leave Turkey, and then circumstances, one thing led to another. I met Diana Anton over online, and one thing led to another. I ended up coming to Chicago, and now she's my wife, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Now, when you were over there, was there during the war and everything, too? I mean, wasn't there the Mideast things and everything going on over
there? Oh, you mean during Iraq?
Turkey
shares a border with Iraq,
right.
Also Iran and Bulgaria and
Syria.
Right,
yeah.
But no, Istanbul is quite far from those borders,
okay.
and even there in the south, it's not a lot happening. Maybe a little more now because of refugees and things.
Mm,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but Istanbul is quite separated from all of that. Yes, yeah, north, you know. So
yeah,
it was a very interesting time, and it led me to open my mind and sensibilities to accept the other sounds, and we're playing with the tempered scale, you know, I'm not playing a fretless guitar or anything like
right,
that,
yeah.
So I'm not saying that, but yes, it did affect me, and I was very happy for that, very blessed to have that experience, yeah.
Well, now, Mark, you came, I'm just going to let you just tell me, where did you come from? Because you're
I've
not originally from
many
Chicago.
Times.
Yeah, I know.
Asked him today, where did you come from?
You're
well,
not originally from Chicago.
No, I'm a Detroit boy.
Right.
But I also went to high school in northern lower Michigan in a small town called Petoskey, which is up at the top of the lower peninsula. And from there, I became interested in jazz, so I moved back to the Detroit area and started studying at Oakland University, where I was fortunate to study theory with a man named Herbie Williams. And he was a trumpet player that did a lot of sessions for Motown. He was from Boston, where he had worked with Charlie Parker and cut a record with him. And then they brought him to Detroit to work for Motown. And he was also a theory teacher there. He had some fairly well-known students,
mm-hmm.
among them Stevie Wonder. So
fairly well-known, yeah.
He was I called him the guru because he just had a way of teaching things that was like nobody else I've known since or before.
Just the way he could explain exactly what he was doing?
Mm-hmm. Just the way he could. And he could also, like, tell when you weren't getting it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he would stay after class for hours. And just, we'd just keep talking about music. And
no kidding.
I'll be standing around, yep. And so that got me involved with a whole lot of the Motown people, and who are, by and large, jazz musicians.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then my first job, actually, my Herbie, my teacher, got it for me. I was, you know, the white guy from the Great White North, and my first job was with disco was big then, so it was with a group called Chapter 8, and they were playing on the east side. And a couple of my friends went with me to audition, and as soon as we got there, they walked out of the building, and they said, "You're the piano player, right?" And I said, "Yeah." Yes, yes.
Don't confuse me.
Yeah, so that was a great learning experience. It was a real good band, too. It ended up, it was a band that Anita Baker was born from.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
What was Detroit like back then? I mean, was it... There's stuff happening then?
Well, at that time, you know, all the older guys I knew would talk about how great it was back in the day in the 50s and 60s when there
Motown
was all kinds of... Well, no, there was all kinds of jazz happening.
Oh, okay.
You know, not everybody would know that Miles Davis lived there for a while and Coltrane stayed there for a while. And, of course, all the people that were from there, from the older generation and the current, sort of current generation... like Regina Carter and James Carter and Jerry Allen and a lot of those people. But even in the 70s, late 70s, early 80s, when I was there, there was lots of work.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was plenty of, lots of jazz places to play, but then also lots of jobbing things you could do and all kinds of top 40 dance gigs. You could get
all throughout
Detroit. Oh, yeah, you could get a six-night jazz or... Mostly pop gig, anytime you wanted.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you end up leaving Detroit?
It wasn't until 2005 or so, and I had been working steadily, you know, real steadily, sometimes 10 jobs a week, and I was regularly playing at the Detroit Jazz Festival, and a lot of nice things happened, and then all of a sudden the economic downturn with the housing market and then the automobiles hit Detroit a lot earlier than most of the rest of the country. So all of a sudden, I had just bought a house. Things were great. And then the work stopped.
All of a sudden, things weren't so great.
Yeah. And so then I got offered a job to be a music director for a show here, Menopause the Musical.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So I came here and did that, and that was interesting.
Hey, you were doing stuff in the summer too, weren't you? You were playing you were telling me about playing at a golf course like 6 days a week and stuff. Was that all when you were living in Detroit or?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that was in the mid 90s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Matt, work was really plentiful until about 2005.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of that wave, and then we always hear about 2007, 2008,
right.
But really that hit Detroit.
Yes, it did.
2005, like wham, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Everything just shut down.
That's right.
So then you ended up coming to Chicago.
Right.
And you were doing Menopause the Musical.
Yep.
And is that how you started working with the Black Ensemble Theater, too, from doing that show, maybe moving into other stuff?
No, that had nothing to do with it. It was a little while after that, at least a couple of years, I guess. Just I actually answered an ad on Craigslist.
Really?
Mm-hmm. They were looking for a keyboard player, and that was a very interesting. I did that for 4 years. Playing keyboards for all their shows, got a chance to delve into gospel and blues and even farther into R&B, which I had already had quite a background with. But just that whole, that's one thing I've always been interested in is diversity in the kind of music I play. You know, I started out being a real fan of alt music and then went through a phase of that, and then I decided, no, I like to hear some chord changes. I want to,
right.
You know, let me hear you play the changes. And so I had a bebop kick for a long time, along with at the same time working a lot of pop,
right,
funk and pop.
Well, and people should know too. I mean, you play piano, you can kick left-handed bass,
mm-hmm.
and then you also sing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I mean, that opens up the door. You can lots of different things, obviously.
Yeah,
I mean, you
that's
can
right.
cover everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
What do you love doing better? Do you love playing just being an instrumentalist, or you like singing and playing?
Oh, I like them both, really. I love to sing, I love to play, so I don't know that there's any one or the other that takes the front seat, but I'm fascinated with harmony, and I love intricate music, but I don't mind playing popular songs. I like that, too,
mm-hmm.
trying to connect with the audience, and it's like everything, you know, the more you do it, the better you get, so...
Did you just start singing when you started playing piano, or is there a story behind how you started singing? Because I've heard all the different stories that different piano players, one from, you know, some guy put a gun on the top of the thing and said, you're going to sing this tune, and they're like, well, I don't sing. Yeah, you're going
yes,
to
you
sing.
Well, I have that reminds me of one time I was working a job, and I was doing a solo piano vocal, and this lady was seemed like she was drinking, you know.
Seemed like it?
Yeah. And she kept coming up to me and asking me for the same song, and I told her I don't know it the first time. She came back. I said, no, I still don't know it.
As you learned it.
It was like 2 minutes ago.
Yeah. So I'm sitting there with the piano with the boom stand, and about the third time I said, I can't play it. She took the boom stand and bam, and knocked me in the mouth with the microphone.
Oh.
Hmm.
Yeah. And I still couldn't play the song. So where do you go from there? I don't know.
That's the story?
I thought. Well, actually, sorry. It just reminded me. Putting the gun on top of the piano.
No, it's good. It's a good story. I just want to make sure we didn't miss anything else.
But I grew up in the suburbs of Detroit as a young child, and my first singing was in the church, and I loved singing in the choir.
Yeah.
Yeah. Catholic Church, we sang all the European music, and Mom always told me I had a good voice. And then my brother got a guitar and started learning all the Peter, Paul, and Mary songs. That was in the mid to late 60s, so I had to do it too.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned all the Peter, Paul, and Mary songs. I loved singing them, and we'd harmonize. And so
it just kind of grew from there.
Mm-hmm. Well, it went for a while where I didn't sing. When I started into college, I was getting to be a serious bebopper, and you know how beboppers feel about those singers.
Right, yeah.
So I jumped on that train for a while, and then I thought, you know, I like singing, and actually, like you said, you can get more work.
You can get a ton of work, I think. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can go play a solo piano gig and sing and everything and entertain people, you know. You know, speaking of that, when you're, you know, I don't know if you've ever done any teaching or anything, but when you're even talking to younger students and stuff, it always amazes me if they're a piano player especially, or a guitar player, Donovan, you can speak to this too, is that wouldn't you, once you start getting a little bit more serious, isn't that something that you would want to try to develop? I mean, even if you maybe it doesn't work out for you vocal-wise, but wouldn't you want to try to develop your voice just for the sure idea that, first of all, you're going to be able to get even deeper into the standards because you're going to learn the lyric, you're going to learn everything. It's going to help your playing probably. But also then the other side of it is you get more work too.
Yeah. Well, I've done – actually, I've had more vocal students than piano students. And even the instrumental students are all told that you have to be able to sing this. If you can't sing it, you can't play it. Yeah. So, you know, when you're reading music, you got to be able to sing those intervals. And the better you can do it, the better you're going to play, and the better in pitch you're going to be, et cetera.
Matter of fact, in Berkeley, I was in the ear training department, and we used to, you know, you teach that through largely through singing.
Yeah.
Ear training, yeah.
Ear training,
and,
sure.
And my first year at the, in Istanbul, my studio, they were all ear training students, and I don't sing as a rule as an artist, but I when I'm teaching ear training, my voice gets stronger, and I use my voice, and I can sing on pitch and so forth, and it's very good for you, yeah. But yeah, it's not as a rule. I never wanted to really be a singer,
right.
but singing and ear training helps your development.
Just overall musicality.
Yes, learning quickly. Learning things quickly, assimilating the musical situation. It's very important.
Yeah. Well, why don't we do this? Why don't we have you guys jump up and play a tune, and then we're going to come back.
Okay.
And we're going to talk a little bit more with Donovan Mixon and Mark Moultrup. I almost called you Mark Montage from Montage World Jazz.
It's not and bad.
Mark Montage. Okay, well, we'll hear a tune, and then we'll be back here on Chicago Jazz Revealed, 90.9 FM, WDCB, and ChicagoJazz.com.
Bags whisk along the sidewalk. As with the darkness, quiet descends upon this Istanbul street behind Yeni Cami, or New Mosque, like an old blanket. After a hot and hectic day of haggling, even the street dogs seem disinterested. Sundry stray morsels of food strewn about on the ground go unnoticed. The sounds you do hear are the grunts of exhausted merchants wrapping up unsold goods, their tired voices fending off the usual cadre of latecomers, covered women looking for last-minute deals. Their gestures are friendly and familiar in a teasing kind of way. There is a graceful give and take, a vying for the most clever comeback. It's like a dance. Thank you.
All right, we're back here at Chicago Jazz Revealed. I'm Mike Jeffers here, live at Katarina's, 90.9 FM WDCB. Of course, Katarina's is at 1920 West Irving Park Road. More information at katarinas.com. Live jazz here 6 days a week. And, of course, you guys are performing live here tonight, which is great. And that last tune that we just heard you guys perform is called?
Dance at the Charsha.
And is that, it's an original, I would imagine?
Yeah, it's an original song I wrote while I was in Istanbul. And Charsha is a Turkish word meaning market.
Mm.
And that's why there's some talk in the beginning about the market and so forth. And it's a song that I haven't released yet, haven't recorded and released yet. But I enjoy it. I hope you did.
Yeah,
but it is one of the tunes that is consistent with the theme of the project we're doing, which is music of other lands and other sounds.
I was just going to ask you that. So that leads me to how you guys actually connected. You must have played a gig together or sat in together or something, and that's when you guys met each other. tell me a little bit about that. You just kind of knew, hey, wait, this is kind of cool, and we should start doing something because the sounds between what you guys were doing kind of meshed.
Yeah, we did. We met at a jam session, and then we actually didn't we get together and just played at my place and your place?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
And then Donovan had Composers Collective job at Green Mill, and I had some little jazz gigs that we were calling each other for, and then I ended up taking a world music class online from Berkeley, and I was fascinated by what I learned on that. And then listening to Donovan's music, I started hearing where that was coming from. So just the concept of using different rhythms and harmonic combinations to as different tools for improvisation was just really appealing.
Yes, and you know, being free with form as well. I remember it started as when I was in Italy, and I remember I wrote this simple song, October, and my friend Aquilo, he says we were rehearsing it, and we got to the last section of the song, and he stopped and he slapped the piano and he said, "Talking on it, Donovan. Can't you just write 8 bars?" It was 7 bars. And you know, I said, "Okay, let's play it 8 bars." And so when we got to the end of the 7th bar, when we started at 8 bars, he stopped. He said, "Okay, yes, it's 7 bars." Like that. But you know, that was one of the things I found myself freed up. And letting the music just guide me in terms of how many measures a certain section is. So consequently, I have a 21-bar blues, and I have, you know.
I've played those, but that wasn't on purpose.
And so these things, it really liberated me with, and, you know, of course, listening to, you know, I didn't invent this, listening to the greats, and you find, this isn't new, you know, and that I let the music and the melodies themselves talk to me and tell me what they need instead of just superimposing forms.
Yeah. Well, and that probably comes, I mean, Mark, you studied this in the class you took with Berkeley, then Donovan probably was exposed to this overseas and everything. Is all of the different cultures and all of the different ways that you can play. But you know, in America, everything gets squeezed into a 32-bar form or a, you know, AABA or something. But when you leave and you go overseas, that's not the case, right? I mean, that's
yeah. But they have their forms too. I mean, I in Istanbul, I discovered that, you know, there's a famous clave 9 that if you play that in Turkey, everybody jumps up and they're going to party. You're like, everybody's going to jump up and start belly dancing. And, you know,
same thing in India.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting thing that really surprised me is that most of the music of other cultures, they have no harmony. It's just drones, like Iran and a lot of the Indian music. It's all single note, and if there's more than one instrument playing the melody, it's unison or octaves.
Yeah. I was amazed by that in Turkey. You go to to the big concert, and there's, I don't know, 24 people on stage with instruments,
yeah,
and with the Comanche and saz and everything, and the ney, the may, and some conventional instruments as well, Western instruments. And they're playing, and it's all monophonic, you know, just all playing in unison together.
Wow.
It was amazing.
Yeah, it's remarkable.
But it also, that too, just being influenced by that, that loosened my concept of for melody,
mm-hmm,
you know, because that's all melody. So I got into thinking more and more about the line, and then the harmony will come, but leave it.
Yeah, mm-hmm, yeah. Well, you know, I mean, the world jazz, you know, montage world jazz. Of course, more information coming soon to world jazz, montageworldjazz.com.
Right, and also already up on Facebook.
Okay.
Montage World Jazz.
M-O-N-T-A-G-E,
mm-hmm,
World Jazz. But, you know, you hear about, okay, well, this is world jazz, that's world jazz, this is, you know, world music, this music, that music. But, you know, when I listen to some of it, some of it's a little bit more Americanized to me.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, that it's they're calling it something, but it's not true like what you're talking about, Donovan, being in Turkey with everything in unison and everything, you know, doing different things. A lot of times, don't you think that people, it's tough to break down the barriers from something that you know so strongly, you know, that you grew up learning.
Well, the influence of Western music all over the world is unstoppable and apparent, and it's done the same thing here, there, that it's done all over, is people want to hear that backbeat and the popular song. And there's, like, people in Australia who are using a diggeridoo with what's basically a rock band.
Mm-hmm.
And they call it world music.
Right, right,
so
yeah.
It's the fundamental get them with the groove and, you know, fundamental chord changes. That's appealing to the masses. So there is a lot of world music that's basically pop or rock.
Right. Well, and it almost goes back to what we were talking about with Bradley Young. Is that Bradley Williams? What am I talking about? I'm getting everybody confused here. Montage, Mark Maltrip, I don't know. But what we were talking about with Bradley was that, you know, it feels good. It's got to be fun.
Right.
I mean, and that's the name of the game, is it's got to be fun. So,
oh, yeah,
I mean,
I'm not talking down about it by any stretch.
But, I mean, that and we were talking Ryan Cohen was on one of the shows earlier, and mm-hmm, he went to Africa,
mm-hmm,
and he did a whole tour of Africa, and he's talking about the drumming, and it gets hypnotic. You get into,
oh, yeah,
this state, it gets hypnotic. Mm-hmm. I mean, they do it for hours and hours and hours and hours. And, you know, that just makes you think, it's like there's so much out there that I think when we're talking about jazz, when we're talking about rock, everybody's putting labels on things. I mean, everybody gets into this thing where they're kind of just staying in the framework. Whereas now what I'm hearing from you guys is that you're kind of thinking outside of the box, and you're not afraid to break out of that box because you don't care. You want, if the melody is going that way and it's a 13-bar form, then it's a 13-bar form because that's what's going on.
Well, one of the things that encouraged us was when we would do each other's jobs, we did mostly original music, and the audience loved it,
yeah,
like all the time.
Yeah, we'd have a good reception, and that's been happening. So I was so happy to meet Mark, to meet someone with a like-minded sensibility, and I admire his music and his musical integrity. So that's very encouraging. And I came here with I began here starting a group, and I wrestled with finding personnel, you know, people that had the same idea. So I had several incarnations of that group.
Yeah.
And it actually was kind of an incarnation of my old group from Istanbul. I called it Hybrid Project and everything. But then things naturally change, and,
mm-hmm,
and I'm happy to have...
well,
and
that's
to
the
this
key
point,
too,
yes,
is finding those like people,
mm-hmm,
with this kind of music, because,
mm-hmm,
I mean, it's not something that you can fake,
mm-hmm,
you know, mm-hmm, to play this stuff. It's not something you can fake.
No, it's not something to fake, but it's, and at the same time, we're not trying to, at least I can say for me, I'm not trying to, when I write something that's influenced by Turkish music, I don't pretend to think, to say I'm writing and playing Turkish music. I understood that very quickly.
Oh, you were influenced.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it can't be that, you know.
Well, so you guys have some out of town stuff coming up, and then from there, I'm sure you're going to start working. Are you guys recording an album or getting close to putting something together like that down the road, maybe in the spring, summer?
Yes, definitely.
So they should visit.
Yes, we're actually working on two incarnations of the group. One is going to be just the two of us. And then we also do things with bass and drums and sometimes saxophone.
Okay. Okay. So all that information will be up on montageworldjazz.com and Facebook Montage World Jazz.
Right.
And why don't we have you guys play some more music for us here?
Okay.
Thanks for coming in. I'm glad you guys made it because, I mean, this is, after I heard you guys this summer, I was like, whoa, that's going to be a really good group.
And thank you, Mike, for the opportunity.
Yeah, thanks, Mike.
Oh, absolutely. Well, why don't we take a listen here to Montage. Mark Moltrip, Donovan Mixon here on Chicago Jazz Revealed, 90.9 FM, WDCB, and Chicago.